welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 128. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, we're looking at a couple of light little films, nothing too heavy, nothing too grim. The first one is from 1987, and it's an old favorite of a lot of people's, Amazon Women on the Moon. And the second one is a not entirely dissimilar film, but much less well known, from 1989. It's a movie called That's Adequate, which has all sorts of people in it. Tony Randall's in it, Bruce Willis is in it, a bunch of other people. And it's a little bit of fun. Both of them satirize certain kinds of movies, and so they're very much in the paleo cinema mode. So grab a drink, sit back, relax, go for a walk if you want to. I do know some people walk when they listen to the podcast, and we will get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a podcast of old movie appreciation. There are only two rules. The first one is the movie has to be at least 20 years old. And the second one is I have to like it or at least appreciate it in some way. Feedback's really, really important to us, so we'd love to get some here. And the contact details are you can email feedback, a voicemail if you like, to kultguru@gmail.com, kultguru@gmail.com. The voicemail number in the United States is 206-337-5398, so you can use that as well. Or you can put a comment through on the Paleo Cinema Cafe on the Book of Faces. This podcast may contain adult concepts and swearing. So if you're not into that sort of thing, it may not be for you, but I do hope you stick around and listen to this show anyway. Take care and enjoy Paleo Cinema. Okay, how is everybody? Here it is very, very warm. Yesterday it got up to 40 degrees, which is about 105 old school. And overnight it didn't drop below 30, which is still pretty hot. And there is a hot wind blowing, and there's going to be a change to the weather, they tell me, very soon. But if you hear some wind blowing against the windows as I record the podcast, I apologize for that, but global warming will have its way. Hope everyone's doing good. We're doing okay here. It is into February, and the living is easy. Nothing too grandiose is happening around here. Just watching movies, going to work, coming home, and enjoying myself. Though there is a little bit going on, and I misspoke just a moment ago. I am back doing the radio gig, which is kind of cool, with Liz Travaskis on ABC Local Radio Darwin. And it's really good fun. We're kind of feeling each other out, what we like, how we're going to format the show, playing off each other. It takes a few episodes to bed that down, but I think we're getting there. First movie we did was La Dolce Vita, the Fellini film, which blew Liz away. We had a lot of fun with that one, really enjoyed it, really did well with it. That was the second film we did. First one we did was Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, then we did La Dolce Vita. And the third film we did was The Red Shoes, the Powell Pressburger movie from 1948, starring Maurice Shearer and Robert Helpman. And Anton Warburg, of course. So that one went really well as well, because Liz is into dance movies, so I thought we'd do The Red Shoes. She hadn't seen The Red Shoes. So it's a good opportunity. We've got a week's hiatus coming up this week, because the radio station is playing some kind of cricket test match in South Africa next week. So after that, we talked a little bit about it on the radio. We're going to do a Philip Seymour Hoffman movie to honour the late actor who unfortunately died last week, as you know. So we're doing The Master. It's a movie neither of us has seen yet. So we're going to go into it cold and just talk around The Master with Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman, have a little bit of have a little bit of a session talking about that, and we'll move on from there. We're probably going to do an Australian movie after that, a movie from 1978 for which I have a lot of time and which I may well do on the podcast at some stage. It's called Newsfront, and directed by Philip Noyce, and it's a good story about newsreel cameramen and newsreel makers in the 1940s and 1950s in Australia. Bill Hunter's in it, and a bunch of other people, you know. It should be a lot of fun, and I will definitely add it to the list to do on the podcast in the not-too-distant future, I hope. So that's pretty much what's going on. I still enjoy going down to the ABC studios and going into the little TARDIS booth and having a chat and that kind of thing. It's different than it was with Ivor, but I don't think it's any worse. I think it's, you kind of play to the presenter's tastes, and that's a good thing. I like the challenge. I like going in a different direction. And Liz is a very nice person, and we're having a lot of fun doing that. Not sure when we're getting up to Darwin next, but we will try to do so this year sometime. And when we do, we'll obviously meet Liz and have a little bit of time, catch up with Ivor and a few other people, and just groove on that as you do. So, on to what I've been watching. As I said, I have got rid of Mizzo because Mizzo sucked, and I'm now going to Letterboxd. If you look up Paleo Cinema without the dash on Letterboxd, you can see my list of movies I have watched in 2014 so far. And let's see what there is of interest. I saw Day of the Dolphin, the George C. Scott movie, which is kind of weird, about a guy training dolphins to speak English, and spooks are trying to get him to lay landmines and all sorts of things like that. I didn't enjoy it as much as I had when I watched it years ago, before I knew that George C. Scott beat up women when he got drunk. And him playing a sympathetic character, even if a gruff, sympathetic scientist, just doesn't work for me anymore. And I find that a bit problematic, and it's a barrier that I can't get past. So maybe I'm not going to enjoy George C. Scott in movies from now on. And if that's the case, there are a lot of other actors out there, which isn't a bad thing. There's tons of people out there. If an actor pisses you off for whatever reason, you've always got the option of going elsewhere. I did see Hitchcock as well, the movie with Anthony Hopkins and Helen Mirren, where he plays Alfred Hitchcock and she plays Alma Revel. And yeah, it's not too good, really. I didn't like it at all. I think the acting was fine, but I think there's something in the script lacking there. Scarlett Johansson playing Janet Leigh was fine. But nah, it's just didn't tell us anything we didn't really know, which is one of the problems with that kind of movie. When you do it about somebody as well known as Hitchcock is, you can tend to, you know, we all knew he was a sleazy prick and a voyeur and a bit of a bastard, and they try to bring Alma Revel into it a lot more by making Helen Mirren play Alma Revel, and from what I know of Alma Revel, the character's not the same. The character is not the character of the human being, which is a little bit of a shame, but it's the way they've chosen to portray it. And for me, it just didn't work. I'm sure there are other people who are fond of the film, but I'm not one of them. Let's have a look here. What else have I watched? I did see a nice little documentary. I don't know whether it's out at the moment, but it's a documentary called Show Me the Magic, The Adventures of Don McAlpine. It's about Don McAlpine, the famous Australian cinematographer, and about how he became a cinematographer, the way he sees the world, what he does when he's not being a cinematographer. Him and his wife tend to travel around the bush and camp out in the outback and take photos and things like that. So it's a nice overview of McAlpine as a person first, and then secondarily as a cinematographer. It's a local production, not a big budget at all, but I saw it on cable here in Australia, and it's worth looking at. It really is an interesting look at the man who's done some fantastic work around the world as a cinematographer. So I recommend that one if you're I'm not going to say if you're a movie geek, because you're not listening to this unless you're a movie geek. But yeah, so that one's definitely highly recommended. Going right to the other end of the spectrum, I did see a very bad movie starring Dan Rowan and Dick Martin from Laugh-In, the 1960s slightly satirical comedy TV show. And it's their feature film, The Maltese Bippy, which I'm not going to talk much about because I don't recommend it. It is a piece of shit. It is incredibly bad and yuck. I'm not sure why I continue to watch it. All I can think possibly is that I was too tired to grab the remote and shut the thing off. But that's, have being said, I'm going to leave it at that. and move on. So the two films I'm talking about this time around, Amazon Women on the Moon, directed partly by people like Joe Dante and John Landis, a satirical look at, more than anything, television, but movies on television as well, which has got a lot of fun stuff in it. I've actually found an extended director's cut, kind of. The extra footage was in the extras on the DVD, but somebody's done a fan edit and placed those extras back into the film, which is kind of interesting and expands the film out by about 20, 25 minutes. Some of them are hit and miss, some of them are not, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. And the second movie is Harry Hurwitz's 1989 film, That's Adequate, which is a kind of guilty pleasure for me when it comes to movies that satirize movies. Done on a low budget, it stars James Coco and Jerry Stiller and Ann Mirror. Even Ben Stiller turns up in the film. And it's a story of Adequate Pictures, a very, very bad movie studio that went on for 60 years from the silent era up until the 1980s, and totally made up, narrated by Tony Randall in a very serious monotone. But that's a lot of fun too. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about Amazon Women on the Moon, and then we'll get into That's Adequate.
Fiesta down in Mexico, and so I stopped a while to see the show. I knew that friend the seaman please love me, and I can say friend the sea. A lovely senorita caught my eye. I stood enchanted as she wandered by, and never knowing that it came from me, I simply sighed friend the sea. She stopped and raised her eyes to mine. Her lips just pleaded to be kissed. Her eyes were soft as candle shine. So how was I to resist? And now without a heart to call my own, a greater happiness I've never known. Because her kisses are for me alone. Who wouldn't say, friend, that's see.
Some time ago,
what happened?
I wandered down into old Mexico.
How come?
Oh, si piwugalo.
While I was there, I felt romance everywhere.
Oh, see.
Moon was shining bright, and I could hear laughing voices in the night. Everyone was gay. This was the start of their holiday. Well, hooray! To call my own, a greater happiness I've never known. Because her kisses are for me alone. Who wouldn't say fantasy?
That was Frenzy by the Four Freshmen. Yes, so on to Amazon Women on the Moon. I'll play the trailer. I'm sure most of us know the movie fairly well. And then go into a little bit about it.
If you like women...
How did a nice girl like you come to contract a social disease?
Astronauts.
1980 will be remembered as a year an American first set foot on the moon.
And you are from South America.
Young people today can't seem to pay attention for more than a few months.
Then you will love... Amazon women on the moon.
I think the Republican Party has done one heck of a job.
See amazing thrills. Spine tingling chills.
Pretty scary, huh?
And something else that rhymes with thrills.
I'll meet you in the Lincoln Room in 5 minutes.
You could do much worse than to see.
Selma, get me out of here!
Amazon women on the moon.
Bullshit or not, you be the judge here on this station.
Okay, we got Amazon Women on the Moon, a 1987 movie directed by Carl Gottlieb, Joe Dante, John Landis, Peter Horden, and Robert K. Weiss. There were two writers on it, Michael Barry and Jim Mulholland. The different segments, pastiche things from coming home from work, late night television movies that you see that are cut to buggery, infomercials, and basically it's a grab bag of media from the 1980s viewpoint, looking back on TV and movies as it was. Now, this is a genre that isn't entirely lost to us. If you might remember from last year, there was a movie which got panned seriously called Movie 43, which I kind of liked parts of better than a lot of other people did. I like the transgressive bits in it particularly, and the fact that they got big stars to do silly things. That's always a nice thing for this kind of movie to do. Now, the genre isn't entirely new. In fact, John Landis himself did the Kentucky Fried Movie in 1977, so it's a genre he knew well. And it borrows a lot from television sketch comedies and things like that, and takes them into a movie context where you can be a bit more transgressive than you could at the time on American television. As I said, the version that I watched this time around was a fan edit where the three missing sketches from Amazon Women of the Moon have been reapplied to the movie. Now, those sketches are, and they're of mixed success, really. A sketch called The Unknown Soldier, another one called The French Ventriloquist Dummy, and a third one, which is the shortest of the three, called Peter Pan. But I'll just go through the sketches and kind of give you a little bit of an idea about them, a bit of a reminder, and we'll take a look at the things that they're satirizing in each of those sketches. The first one was directed by John Landis. It's Mondo Kondo, starring Arsenio Hall, who I believe had an American talk show that never reached Australia for some reason. A guy comes home from work and everything that can go wrong does go wrong. It's very physical comedy. It escalates wonderfully, and I think it's paced together quite interestingly. Not a long sketch, but it does take you to some interesting places. You know, a guy opens a beer, sits down, tries to watch a video, tries to watch television, answers a wrong number phone call that keeps calling back and that kind of thing. So I think Arsenio does a good job in this one, playing it very broadly as you need to with this kind of thing, and just doing the physical comedy stuff as well. Then they get into one which apparently there's a TV edit of this where the Monique Gabriel playing Taryn Steele in the Pet House Pet video wears lingerie, but in this full version she's nude, and it's basically one of those "this is what my life's like" videos that used to show up with a lot of the Playboy and Penthouse videos. So it was a genre which at the time I was not entirely unfamiliar with, though it's, again, it goes through the trivialities of those kind of things and takes the piss out of it. That was directed by Carl Gottlieb, who also directs the best of these videos, best of the sketches, in fact, that I'll talk about in just a moment. So we then go into Mario and Videoland, which is a very good absurdist premise, but I'm not sure that they take it far enough. Basically, Murray's an old Jewish guy played by Lou Jacoby, who gets a new remote control and accidentally projects himself into the television. And whichever channel his wife Selma, played by Erica Jong, changes to, Murray's on the TV in the movie or the TV show or whatever it is. It's a concept that's kind of a bit hit and miss, and I think if it was done these days, it'd be escalated even further, and you'd end up having something like Murray in torture porn or something like that to escalate it. Now, the next one's the one I like the least.
hospital with Michelle Pfeiffer and Peter Horton as a couple in a hospital. They've just had a baby, and the doctor, played by Griffin Dunn, loses the baby. Now, that one I don't like so much. I think it's a little soft. Some people think it's okay. It was actually directed by John Landis, but it's more, I think it's not quite as developed as it should be. And Michelle Pfeiffer in particular doesn't, you know, takes it as a serious acting role rather than ramping up the hysteria just a little bit to play it a bit more broadly. I don't think she's really suited to this kind of comedy, if she indeed she's suited to much comedy at all. And it kind of falls apart because of that, her and Peter Horton trying to do serious acting in something which patently doesn't require serious acting. Then there's a little infomercial directed by Joe Dante with Joe Pantoliano, Joey Pants, Hair Looming, where he plays a guy called Cy Swerdlow, who invents a method of basically putting carpet on people's heads when they go bald as an alternative to hair. And, yeah, it's a nice little satire. It doesn't outplay its welcome. It's a nice little satire about those late-night hair loss commercials, which are still appearing apparently now. If you beam laser beams onto people's heads, they won't go bald. I'm not sure how well that works, but it is something that's trying to be sold. Then we get to the titular sketch, which continues throughout the movie, being Amazon Women on the Moon, which is directed quite well by Robert K. Weiss. It's very much in the genre of things like Fire Maidens from Outer Space and Cat Women on the Moon. It uses spacesuits from Destination Moon, those big puffy ones, and has a little bit of fun with that. You got Steve Forrest playing Captain Steve Nelson. Now, Steve Forrest, I remember from a TV series that ITV did in the UK called The Baron, where he played like an international art dealer, an antiques dealer, who gets involved in various adventures and hits character actors. And, yeah, he seems to be a little bit stiff in this, playing the kind of stiff characters that they had playing the captains of the spaceships who go to other planets and find beautiful women who don't have any men. Steve Forrest acted like that pretty much all the time. It was very much a stereotyping role for him, for the simple reason that his range wasn't tremendously good. He's one of those 1950s actors who got a studio contract because they were tall and good-looking, and basically that was pretty much it. So that one's got a couple of nods to the genre as well. It's got Robert Colbert from The Time Tunnel playing Blackie's offsider. Joey Travolta, whom I believe is related to John Travolta, playing Butch, who's the kind of comedy sidekick they always had in these ones. I never understood those 1950s movies where they'd send up pig-ignorant people who knew nothing at all about space travel, physics, the universe, science, or anything apart from maybe running a radio and women. I never understood why they always put those characters in there. Comic relief can be a bit better than that. And that's one of the things that takes me out of a movie. It happens in Destination Moon and a few others, Conquest of Space. It's just got that kind of comic sidekick actor that's totally superfluous to needs. And it's also got Furry J. Ackerman playing the US president. Furry J. Ackerman was a science fiction fan dating back as far as the 1930s. He did Famous Monsters of Filmland. I met him once in 1998, and he showed me his ring, which was the one that Bela Lugosi wore in Dracula. And he was quite a polite guy, very tall, and very personable as well. Then, of course, you've got Sybil Danning playing Queen Lara. Sybil Danning we know from any number of things. I first saw her in The Long Swift Sword of Siegfried, a soft porn movie made in the 1970s, but people remember her as St. X-Men from Battle Beyond the Stars, the science fiction remake of The Magnificent Seven and, of course, The Seven Samurai. And then there's Alpha Beta, played by Lana Clarkson, who unfortunately is better known for being shot and killed by Phil Spector than she is for anything she did in her career, which is pretty sad. But unfortunately, at a certain level of fame, female actors do get known for the negative things much more than they do for the positive things, which is a shame. She wasn't bad in the role, but yeah, it's one of those things where sometimes we as the public get a glimpse of people whom Hollywood has chewed up and spat out. And I think, unfortunately, she's one of the more extreme cases of that, which is kind of sad. Then we get into some really good stuff. By the way, the Amazon Women on the Moon sketches, yeah, they're kind of accurate to those 1950s science fiction space women planet movies. And there's a really nice thing is too is there's some outdoor scenes filmed up at Velasquez Rocks, which are well known for things like the original series Star Trek episodes where Captain Kirk and other people went out to Velasquez Rocks to fight with the Gorn and things like that. So it's nice to have that kind of nod there and that knowing look. It's a bit like having a modern science fiction film where they have a scene at Bronson Caves, for instance. And then we get into another infomercial directed by John Landis, Blacks Without Soul, starring David Alan Grier as Don No Soul Simmons. Now, this one I like because the idea of B.B. King starting a charity for black people who have absolutely no idea of their own culture is kind of fun. And David Alan Grier puts across the, and this is used advisedly, white bread Don No Soul Simmons really well, going full tilt at songs like Chim Chim Cheree and Joy to the World, with absolutely no tongue-in-cheek. He plays it like it's totally straight and over the top, and that this guy's got no idea of how naff he actually is, and that kind of puts it across wonderfully. Then we get on to the kind of interesting one, Two IDs, directed by Peter Horton, where Rosanna Arquette and Steve Guttenberg are about to go on a date, and she does the kind of very early equivalent of looking up his Facebook page, in a sense, and finding out his dating history from a computer database, which prints out on a wonderfully scratchy dot matrix printer. And she gives him chapter and verse on his previous dating history, and we find out that he's basically a sleazebag asshole who turns a little passive-aggressive at the end too, which is kind of interesting to see. And both of them, again, play it kind of right. Where Michelle Pfeiffer didn't play it right, this one's played a little bit over the top. Not too much, but just that little bit, so that both Guttenberg and Arquette are playing at the right level for the kind of material it is. I like that. They do a good job on that one. And it's interesting seeing a kind of early form of kind of data mining on a person before you date them, which is kind of cool, and I like that. We then get to one of my favorites, and I'm going to play the punchline, which comes about a minute and a bit into the sketch, which is kind of cool. It's a satire on a TV series from the 1970s and 80s called In Search Of, which was, you know, looking at UFOs and crystal spaceships and all sorts of weird, wonderful things, yetis and cryptozoology and things like that. At one stage, it was narrated by Leonard Nimoy, but this one takes it in a different direction and does a mashup between a couple of the different tropes in this kind of a TV series. And the setup for it is wonderful. And, of course, it has in it one of our friends over at Silver and Gold's icons, Henry Silver, doing the narration. So I'll just play a minute or so of that to get to the punchline. And after that, you won't need to know why this one's good. It's the second best sketch in the thing.
Extraterrestrials. Strange phenomena. Missing persons. Lost continents. Myths. And monsters.
We examine these mysteries to determine, are they bullshit or not?
London's West End. Here, in the winter of 1888, a series of bizarre and violent murders occurred, which remain unsolved to this very day. Jack the Ripper. Was he a prosperous London surgeon? Perhaps a member of British royalty? Well, a bullshit team has unearthed spectacular new evidence, which suggests that Jack the Ripper was, in fact, the Loch Ness Monster.
There's not much more to say about that one, really, is there, except for the fact that the reenactments are even funnier than that bit, and I kind of like that a lot. Then we get into another Joe Dante one. That one was directed by Joe Dante. Critics Corner, where a couple of movie critics critique the life of one of the people watching them on television and saying what a miserable, heartless and nasty thing it is. This is kind of a setup for the second part of Critics Corner, which is a little bit later on, called Roast Your Loved Ones, again directed by Dante, where basically they do the funeral of the character played by Archie Hahn, Harvey Pitnick, as a Friars Club roast or a celebrity roast of some kind, with quite famous old-school comedians at the time, Rip Taylor, Slappy White, Jackie Vernon, Henny Youngman, Charlie Callis, and Steve Allen. There's an extended version of this on the fan edit, which also has one of the paramedics who come to pick up Harvey when he has his heart attack. And it's a young Bryan Cranston in one of his first roles, which is kind of interesting to see as well. So there you go. And then on to another favourite, directed by Robert K. Weiss, which is the Video Pirates thing with William Marshall. Basically, they use the term video pirates literally and have pirates attacking a ship to get VHS cassettes and Betamax cassettes and video discs from the people who own them. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's a single idea sketch and it follows it through nicely. And William Marshall, who everybody knows, played Blackula in both Blackula and Scream, Blackula Scream, does really good as a pirate captain too. It's nice seeing a black pirate captain rather than the usual English guy. Then we get to the best of this movie, which is, it was directed by Carl Gottlieb, Son of the Invisible Man, with Ed Begley Jr. in it. Basically, they do a perfect reconstruction of a 1930s Universal horror film like The Invisible Man. The colour looks right, the black and white looks right, the lighting looks right, the kinds of actors they have in there, the set design is right, the dialogue's perfect, but they take it into another direction. If you haven't seen Son of the Invisible Man, it is a pisser. It really is good. It does the concepts really well, and probably if you haven't seen it, watch The Invisible Man first, the original one with Claude Rains in it. Then watch this, because you'll get a lot more from it if you're familiar with the original source material. But it's a beautiful pastiche and a beautiful comedy pastiche, and done extremely well. They really put the money into getting the set design and everything right, and it pays off enormously well. It's just a lot of fun there. Then we get into another one, which is one of the missing ones that only turned up later on, was put into the fan edit and to the extras on the latest DVD release of Amazon Women on the Moon. And that is French Ventriloquist Dummy with Dick Miller, who we know from any number of Roger Corman films, playing a Las Vegas ventriloquist who has been to a ventriloquist convention in Paris and has picked up the wrong dummy from the airport. And it follows through quite interestingly on that. It's not a really great one, but it's not bad either. And it kind of has a nice little second act bit in there that kind of works well. I think it should have been developed a little more in some ways, but again, it harks back to previous stuff in media, particularly the famous piece in the Portmanteau movie, Dead of Night, with Michael Redgrave and Hugo the ventriloquist dummy. It gives us a kind of comedy spin on that unease we have about ventriloquist dummies and that uncanny valley that they fall into for a lot of people. Then there's a couple of small bits. Art Sale, where they're selling off a museum worth of artwork. First Lady of the Evening, which is a piss take on Sidney Sheldon novels. It's kind of dated a little bit, but it does have one of my favourite minor female actors from the 1970s, and it's Angel Tompkins, who I saw in a few things and was quite enamoured of in my day. which was kind of cool. Then we get into another one directed by Mr. Weiss, which was Titan Man, which is one of those things. Kelly Preston, who I think is married to John Travolta and is the date of a young guy called George, played by Matt Adler, who has to go in and get some condoms because they're going to do it. And then you've got Ralph Bellamy, who we know from anything going back to the 1930s, playing the old pharmacist who has to get him the condoms out. And that kind of plays in an interesting way too, and plays into our media obsessions now in an interesting way. Then we get Video Date, where directed by John Landis, where Mark McClure, who played Jimmy Olsen in the Christopher Reeve Superman movies, plays a guy called Ray, who goes to a video shop run by Russ Meyer and rents a very special videotape. I'm not going to say much more about that one, but it is kind of fun in it, but it plays out in a way that you could pretty much predict if you've ever seen something like Kentucky Fried Movie, because there's a sketch in that that parallels this one to a certain extent. Then we get to another really good one, directed by Joe Dante, called Reckless Youth, with Carrie Fisher, Paul Bartel, Mike Mazurki in it, and Herb Vigran, who was a character actor whose face you'll recognize for any number of things. Basically, it's a piss take on those 1930s hygiene films, which were all about unwanted pregnancies and venereal disease and the dangers of marijuana and cocaine. Well, yeah, cocaine is dangerous. But basically, it does a wonderful piss take on that. And again, the dialogue, the acting, and the sets are kind of great there. And Carrie Fisher really has fun with this one too. It's a couple of years after Star Wars, and she just plays it the way it should be played if you've seen any of those movies. And they're all over YouTube, so you should be able to find them if you need to. But that one plays well. That's a kind of post-credits sequence. Then we get on to the other... let's see, there's two missing sketches from the film. The first one being The Unknown Soldier, which has a great cast. I'm not going to spoil it by telling you too much about it, but it's a kind of... It's set in an army bunker towards the end of a war. And it's got Robert Loggia in it. It's got Bernie Casey in it. It's got Ronnie Cox in it. And it's funny, but it's stretched a little bit too long. It just, there's something wrong with the pacing in there that kind of doesn't make it work and makes you understand why they might have taken it out of there. And there's a little coda at the end of it, which makes it a little more serious than it would have been otherwise. But, it kind of works, and I always like Robert Loggia in things, so I'll kind of go with that one as well. And then there's a Peter Pan one, which, unless you've seen a stage version of Peter Pan, doesn't play well. But it does have Jenny Agutter in it, which makes it kind of interesting as well. And, yeah, it's fairly short again, and it kind of doesn't outstay its welcome. I think it might have been like 30 seconds too long, but nothing more than that. So just to wrap up Amazon Women on the Moon, I like it. I do like it. It's something I revisit now and then. I think that it was done on a budget of around $500,000, so you can't expect it to be more than it is, and for them to have taken more time and care to sharpen up a couple of things. I mean, it would have been a better film had they had the ability to do that, but you've got to accept the fact that it was basically made for the VHS market in a sense, even though it did get a theatrical release, even here in Australia. I think I saw it in the cinema the first time it came out. But it's one of those movies that really thrived during the VHS era and was constantly being rented at my local video stores because people who hadn't seen it watched it in groups. It's one of those movies that does really well if you see it in groups, and it does well with an audience of people who know movies. If you go in there not knowing anything about cinema and not knowing anything about the history of cinema, you're going to get a lot less out of it than you do if you go in there with just that little bit of nous about things. And you kind of, you don't just have the latest things on your shelves of your videos and DVDs. I phrase that so badly. Thank you for that. But anyway, I'm just going to take another break now. And when I get back, we're going to talk about the second one of these types of films, and one that I kind of like. It's about as much as I like Amazon Women on the Moon, which is Harry Hurwitz's 1989 movie about a really bad movie studio. That's adequate.
Hollywood, land of magic and fantasy. The Dream Factory, whose products have entertained, inspired, and informed the peoples of the world for decades. The film you are about to see celebrates the 60-year history of a lesser-known studio, Adequate Pictures, which for six decades has produced an almost endless stream of low-budget, seldom-released, often misunderstood masterpieces. It all began with this man, Max Roebling.
So, that's adequate. It's a 1989 film. Some people quote it as 1988, some quote it as 1990, but it's actually a 1989 film directed by Harry Hurwitz. It's the only movie in history that stars both Robert Downey Jr. and Bruce Willis, though they don't have any scenes together in the film. I just checked it on IMDb, and I'm right about that. So basically, it's a story of a movie studio that doesn't exist. It's a mockumentary, in a sense. And very patchy as well. It stars James Coco as Max Roebling. Way back in an early Paleo Cinema podcast, I talked about a movie with James Coco in it called The Wild Party that he did with Raquel Welch. And in this one, he's good. He plays basically the studio head, who's a drunken, lustful, moronic bastard. Goes all the way from the silent era, and I'll play something from one of Adequate Pictures' silent era movies, which gives you a bit of an idea. And it gives you a really good idea of how in-depth into the history of movies this particular mockumentary goes.
And so Adequate began its illustrious history, introducing many of the great silent Adequate stars, such as Guido Valentine. It is a little-known fact that Guido died during the filming of Throbbing Sands, and most of his close-ups were shot after he was dead.
It was a very difficult scene to play. I had never worked with a dead person before. They kept him on ice, but it was very hot where we were filming. They had trouble keeping the flies away. Actually, he was very good for a dead man.
So as you can see on the scale of things, this movie's a lot more transgressive than Amazon Women on the Moon. So here, I'll just give you a little bit of an idea of some of the things that they pastiche in this movie. Really good. Gone with the Wind, they do a silent version, not unlike Gone with the Wind, called Slut of the South, which was a porno movie they did as a silent film. The Klondike Kid, which is a takeoff of Chaplin. And it's got a pastiche of that scene of Chaplin and the little boy eating the shoe from one of his silent movies. I forget which one, but it's quite a good one. They actually do a piss take on The Jazz Singer, which is really, really funny, called Singing in the Synagogue, which is about the son, a black son of a vaudeville entertainer who wants to be a cantor in a Jewish synagogue, which goes kind of funny. And they've got a kind of pastiche on the Marx Brothers with the Muck Brothers, Crocho, Pazzo, and Psycho. They have a talking gorilla who talks like Cary Grant in a movie called Barry Goes to the Rescue with Barry the Talking Gorilla in it. They've got a really, really dark and sick parody on the Three Stooges. They have a go at newsreels. And as the 1930s come on, they even have a go at doing colour films, only they can't afford all the colours, so they have different weeks with different coloured movies. So one week would be a red coloured movie, another week would be some other colour movie. And they have a really cool film in that called Abraham Lincoln versus the Metal Men. And the whole thing about this film is they use a lot of stock footage and a lot of footage from public domain movies to tell this story, so you get all sorts of really interesting little mix-ups between things. So Throbbing Sands has got some solid film footage of Rudolph Valentino in it. And, it's just, again, it's at the level of Son of the Invisible Man from Amazon Women on the Moon. but they kind of go in different directions with it. And as the 1930s close, there are alternative sources for funding for adequate pictures. In fact, Robert Vaughan has a really nice piece in this, playing out of Hitler making a speech in English about the collaboration between Nazi Germany and adequate pictures, and saying that things like the Klondike Kid and singing in the synagogue inspired his racial ideas. And Robert Vaughan was actually an academic, apart from being an actor, and has done some work on the history of Nazi Germany as a part of his academic career. So he knew what he was talking about, and he does have Hitler down pat. It really is amazing how good he is at that. But this movie goes on to do pastiches of all sorts of things. They've got a pastiche of both Rambo and John Wayne in a movie called Blood and Guts. They've got The Day the Toilets Overflowed. They've got a pastiche on Psycho in here, which takes off Hitchcock's propensity for cameos in his movies. They then go into pastiching TV shows because Adequate Pictures, not being able to continue as a movie studio, goes on and that makes television series such as this.
Then they made a children's show that emphasized discipline.
Instantly, the forest turned black. Pitch black! And a giant bat came and baked him in an oven and ate him for dinner, limb by limb, organ by organ. What a night. Now, what's the moral of the story? Hmm? I mean, what does the story teach us? I'll tell you. Obey your mommy and daddy, always. Or else, terrible things will happen to you. Ghastly things, ghoulish things, ghoulish and grotesque. Especially at night.
The show was so terrifyingly effective on test audiences of young children that several of the preschoolers had to undergo psychiatric treatment. The studio received an unprecedented amount of hate mail.
That was Brother Theodore, a New York-based monologist who told ghastly tales. And there isn't a lot of footage of Brother Theodore around doing a monologue, but that is one of them. Now, this, as I said, is one of the few movies that stars both Bruce Willis and Robert Downey Jr. It's the only movie in the history of the universe, well, this universe at least, which has Robert Downey Jr. playing Einstein. The movie in question, inside That's Adequate, is Einstein on the Bounty.
Attempting to keep in touch with the youth market, Adequate hired 12-year-old Georgie Spielman.
Hello. It's an honor to make my first feature-length film for Adequate Pictures. I hope to bring to the production a little bit of every film I've seen in all my 12 years of moviegoing. This will be the first in a series of films based on the lives of great men, such as Albert Einstein, Sigmund Freud, and Louis Pasteur. It will be entertaining and will appeal to the millions of kids that make up the majority of moviegoers.
Looks like we lucked out, boys. Got to that one by the skin of our balls, huh? Yep.
Look at that, girls on the beach, especially the ones that aren't on fire.
You know, there's a lot to learn here, you know. One can contemplate the secrets of time, space, matter, energy. Oh, bullshit. Molecules heating, gases expanding, atoms colliding, matter exploding. It's just fucking brilliant. Wait, let me see. I was on to something. E equals MA, no.
Jesus Christ, I got it! Time, space, matter, energy, E equals M fucking C squared! Ah! Oh, shit! Look, it's the pirates from the Berlin Academy of Physics. They roam the seas looking for radical physicists with new ideas. Up with their heads! Yeah!
One of the things that happened in the later parts of the movie is interviews with real celebrities who basically improvise their history with Adequate Pictures and Max Roebling. And one of them happens to be a moonlighting era Bruce Willis, who has this to say about his early career with Max Roebling.
Well, Max Roebling gave me my start in this business. It was 1971. There wasn't a whole lot of work in Hollywood in town at that time. I had known Max. I'd, you know, knocked on his door a lot of times. Maxie, I called him. This little thing I called him personally. He gave me a part as a Shetland pony.
They put you in a pony costume?
I have some fine memories of that time. I got a couple other animal parts after that. I played a German Shepherd in it. It was the thing, you know, it was right around the time Lassie was kind of getting real big, and Max had an idea for a spinoff about kind of a Rin Tin Tin-ish combination of Lassie and Rin Tin Tin. It was like an undercover dog. I was a wild wolf, a wild dog who met a young group of collies, and we became friends. We started running around. It was kind of like a Rat Pack movie with dogs.
Now, there's a second third, the last third of That's Adequate, where Jerry Stiller and Ann Mirror play a couple who of he's a millionaire female underwear maker who gets involved in financing Adequate Pictures, and they kind of play off that for a while, and they decide to do a version of Anna Karenina starring Ann Mirror, whose character Charlene can't act, and goes on with that. And in that, you also get Ben Stiller turning up as the son of the character played by Jerry Stiller and Ann Mirror, who are his parents. But I'm not sure how well that one plays out. It does look like, I think there's about a 3 or 4 year period during which Harry Hurwitz was making this movie. I think it's patched together from a whole bunch of different things when he could get the funding for it. And this kind of very much plays like that to a certain extent. There's a Star Wars pastiche in there, which is kind of a bit of fun in some ways, and a few other things which kind of go into it. But it kind of gets off track and loses that initial impetus it has as a mockumentary about filmmaking, and goes into being a mockumentary about the characters played by Jerry Stiller and Ann Mirror. But in spite of that, I kind of like it. It's one of those things where it's a pastiche on a lot of things I know about movies. It's a pastiche on a lot of things I like about movies. And I think putting it together out of stock footage and found footage and public domain movies and doing all that is something that I think Harry Hurwitz did a pretty good job of in a way. It's not laugh out loud funny, it's adequate, boom tish, and it's one I keep coming back to every few years because I kind of like it, and I like the idea of such an inept movie studio making every wrong move it possibly can in and yet lasting 60 years. It kind of tells me a little, it reflects something that I see in a number of movie studios today, and in that it's a lot of fun for that reason. It's not available on DVD. It is available on VHS. You can pick one up for pocket change on eBay. There's a few copies of it there, and it's also available on Torrent if you look around the place. And it's a bit of fun. If you know movies, it's a good fun flick to watch, and very much, as I said, in the vein of Amazon Women on the Moon. Has enough well-known faces in there. I don't know how they did it. The budget can't have been very much for this film. And there are bits that hit and miss, just as there are in Amazon Women on the Moon. That's the thing with sketch-based movies like this. Sometimes the sketches play tremendously well, some of them less so. And that, I suppose, is the nature of any kind of sketch medium, in that depending on the professionalism of the writers and the actors and the skill that they've got and the talent that they've got, and also depending on the preferences of the audience, a sketch can succeed or fail, and there are a lot of variables there to play with in getting that done. Now, having said that, I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I've got some feedback. And before I do the feedback, I'd just like to say kia ora to my Kiwi friends over in New Zealand and play you one of your national songs, because this last week it was Waitangi Day, which is the national day of New Zealand. Here you go.
Moana Marie, she waits so patiently in the sleepy little town where soft breezes blow. There's a lovely little Maori miss I used to know. Someday I will find my way and I'll return from over the sea to where my island sweetheart waits for me.
That was John Rolls with Cheryl Moana Marie, one of the great songs of New Zealand. So I've got a piece of feedback here from Thomas Dale in Canberra. Tom Dale in Canberra says, "G'day Terry, as I have the distinction of being one of the three reviewers of PCP, Paleo Cinema Podcast, on iTunes, where is everyone else? I feel obligated to finally drop you a line from the national capital. Just listen to your thoughts on Green for Danger and we'll track it down at a large Black and Yellow retailer ASAP." He means JB Hi-Fi. "I read the book a couple of years ago and found it good but not great crime fiction. I think the classic British whodunit can drag a bit in print. There's a real cliche trap such that you sometimes think you have landed in the game of Cluedo. But when put on the screen and delivered by really good actors like Trevor Howard and Alastair Sim, with interesting period detail, that can be great fun. I really enjoyed the review of They're a Weird Mob. I can remember seeing this at the Skyline Drive-In in Newcastle with my mum, dad and sister. And as we were not long arrived in Australia from the UK, we found it pretty funny. Now looking at it, I watched it on Foxtel last year. I agree that it stands up as a decent movie and is not just the historical curiosity some have labelled it. A more innocent Australia then, of course, but no point in getting nostalgic, especially when the choice of beer is infinitely better now in this country. I continue to enjoy the podcast, delving at random into older episodes, and still find it a source of inspiration slash motivation in watching interesting movies. Cheers, Tom Dale in Canberra." Thanks for that, Tom. To address the first issue, you've got to go into the iTunes for each individual country to find the iTunes reviews. So right down the bottom, there's a little flag, a circular flag, at the bottom of the iTunes review page, which you can change to different countries. I've got to do that to look at my reviews, so I've got to go into the US iTunes to look at the US reviews and the UK ones and whatever else is going. I may have to go through the whole United Nations, and eventually I'll clock up all of my reviews. It's just the nature of things and the nature of stupid copyright laws and the rights to things that iTunes does it that way. So, yeah, a bit of a pain, but that's the way it is. And you can see the other reviews there if you want to. Yeah, I agree. I do find British whodunits are a bit draggy. British action fiction, though, is pretty good. People like Peter O'Donnell, Ian Fleming, of course, and a bunch of others do that well, but those whodunits can drag a little. And I do have that problem with the fact that nobody gives a shit about the dead person particularly. I really have an issue with that as a trope of that kind of fiction. But, yeah, I see what you mean. But Green for Danger, you should be able to find it there. It's in a three-pack of movies. It should be in the classic section. And I picked up for about $8, I think it was. So good luck in finding that. I hope you do, because that's a series of three-pack DVDs is pretty good, and you find some interesting things in there as well. But, yeah, they're a weird mob I've had a fondness for a long time because, of course, it's filmed in my hometown. But, yeah, it does hold up better these days than it did, say, 10 or 20 years ago for some reason. And that's one of the things with movies, too. You get waves of acceptance of them. The look of 1960s kind of op art movies is really popular these days because hair and makeup have moved around to being like that again to a certain extent. So the look of people in these movies is a bit more contemporary because of the way styles come in cycles. 1980s movies, everybody with the permed hair and the puffy shoulders and the shoulder pads and all that kind of thing don't play well these days because of that change in fashion and the change in style and the way that guys never had any sideburns. So there's all those kind of things that roll into this, but there are also cultural things like the multiculturalism that is in a very kind of rude, crude form there in They're a Weird Mob, is something about which, unnecessarily to my viewpoint, we're still having arguments about these days. And so those things are important. But thanks, Tom. I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast. I'll keep doing it as long as people are. And I'll try to throw in some Australian movies now and then. I think Newsfront may have to come up sooner or later on that. Now, that's the feedback I got for the last Paleo Cinema. I do have a couple of things to say, though. First thing is I'm going to try to get some of the talks I have with Liz recorded so that I can play them at the end of Paleo Cinemas. I did try and experiment with one last podcast, and because I was doing other things on the netbook while I was streaming and recording that audio, the audio fucked up. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do it on a PC, and I've got a couple of laptops around the place. I'm going to do it on one of my laptops that I'm not doing anything else on, and the stream should then come through clearly. So in about 2 or 3 weeks, I should have another film talk from ABC Darwin to play on Paleo Cinema. The other thing I was going to say is I've got this thing going at the moment. The first person to put up a Paleo Cinema podcast Wikipedia page. Now, I can't do it because I'm the podcast. You can't do one for yourself. So I'm willing to provide information to people if they will need information about how the podcast started and things like that. But the first person to put up a Wikipedia page for Paleo Cinema podcast gets to pick two of the movies I talk about on the podcast. Any two films more than 20 years old and that don't have nuns in them in a serious context or aren't serious religious films. They're the only criteria I give you. More than 20 years old and not religious propaganda films. So if you want to have a go at that, I'm more than happy to accept the gift and give back to you in the sense of giving you a go at the movies that we talk about. So that's about it for this time around. I will be back in 2 weeks with something else entirely. Look after yourselves in the meantime. If you're down here, stay cool. If you're in Darwin, stay dry because the wet season has hit pretty heavily up there at the moment in the territory. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, stay warm. If you're watching the Sochi Olympics, you homophobic, you bastard. I'm not watching any of that because A, I don't like watching sport, and B, I don't like encouraging countries that do the wrong thing by portions of their population. I don't like Australia for the same reason, really, when you come to think of it. But anyway, I'll be back in a fortnight's time. Take care of yourselves, and see you then.
Do you know Wayne Newton?
Yeah, I know Wayne Newton.
Really?
What about Tell me something. Tell me something. When you first heard Wayne Newton sing,
yeah,
did you think he was a girl?